The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're talking about science and storytelling. Guest host Marie Claire Shanahan talks to Deborah Blum, author of The Poisoner's Handbook, a fascinating tale of murder, chemistry, and the birth of forensic science. And it happens to be completely true. Enjoy.
I'm Marie Claire Shanahan, guest host this week for Desiree Shell. Today I'm here with Deborah Blum, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer, professor of science journalism at the University of Wisconsin, and author of, most recently, The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York. So, Deborah, I have to start by asking you how you ended up writing a book about poison. It seems a rather grim topic.
You know, it makes me sound so creepy, but I wrote that book after my agent said to me, why don't you write that poison book you've always wanted to write? And I kind of did cartwheels around the house. I had wanted to write a book about poison for a while, and for a number of reasons. One is I love murder mysteries, but I especially grew up with early 20th century ones, Agatha Christie and Dorothy Sayers and Rex Stout, say, and a lot of those writers really wrote very subtle, intricate, brilliant poison murder mysteries that had just kind of stayed with me, the calculation of them and the creepiness of them. And I think that was the other thing, was I was just interested in poisoners. They're unusual killers in that they're always premeditated. You know, any other crime, any other weapon, right? You can pretty much pick up by impulse a baseball bat, a gun, a knife, a brick. But with poison, you don't say, well, I'm really mad at you, and so I'm going to go research what might be the best lethal poison. And maybe a few months from now, I'll put that in your oatmeal. Poisoner's plan. That was really interesting to me. And then I guess the last thing, and this is kind of a long answer, is that I had been thinking about the best, about communicating chemistry. I'm a very failed chemistry major from way back when. And I wanted to find a way to kind of subversively write about chemistry, to tell stories that I could weave chemistry into without, you know, being a tutorial. Just kind of, this is a really cool story. And along the way, you're going to learn some chemistry. And I thought, well, there's no better way to do that than to tell a murder story. So all of that kind of went into why I wanted to write the book.
Cool. I noticed actually that it's framed a lot from talking about chemistry. The prologue of the book kind of jumps in and talks about the chemical revolution. But the title itself doesn't say Murder and the Birth of Forensic Chemistry or...
No.
Was that a conscious choice?
When I came up with the brilliant title for the book, I picked The Poisoner's Handbook because I wanted the book to be a handbook of poisons. And if you actually kind of flip through it chapter by chapter, you'll see that the title of every chapter is a poison along with the chemical formula for that poison. The subtitle that I had given them was A True Story of Chemistry, Murder, and Jazz Age New York. And the Penguin marketing team said no. They said, people aren't going to buy a book with chemistry in the subtitle. Chemistry is like a book buyer, deal breaker thing. And so we're not going to put, you can't put that in there. And they came up with a bunch of titles that I kind of snottily rejected. And I think part of it is I had been saying to myself in a kind of geeky way, well, I'm going to get chemistry on the cover of the book. My editor finally said to me, what is wrong with you? You're not going to win this and pick the best of these. And they wanted forensic. They wanted murder, but they wanted forensic in the title. Mm-hmm. And so, hence, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York became the subtitle. So I lost that one. There is a test tube on the cover, though. So
there
that's
is.
A win.
Yes.
It's a moon, too. I love that. If you look at the cover, the test tube glows at the bottom and becomes the moon shining over a vintage New York City scene. It is really, really cool.
So actually, you mentioned in the book that each chapter is titled with a name of a poison and a chemical formula. And as you go through, each of those chapters kind of tells the story of a particular poison, some of its victims and how the tests were developed to detect it. How did you end up choosing those representative stories to represent each of those poisons?
Oh, that's really an interesting point. So the book, it was complicated to write because it's both this catalog or handbook of poisons, right? But it's also the story of these two dedicated scientists in New York City who are trying to figure out how to catch poisoners and really literally to build the science of forensic toxicology and forensics in general. And that to me was a really important point because we take for granted the kind of CSI age that we live in today, and it didn't exist then. So as I was telling this story, I wanted to follow these scientists as they're creating the CSI world we know today, and I wanted to tell it through a series of poisons that they encountered, poisons that they took on as obstacles and had to kind of triumph over. And to some extent, that was selective. For instance, I had really planned from the beginning to do a chapter about strychnine, which is a really cool homicidal poison with a great history, and I had all this research on it and books just about strychnine, and I couldn't find a single case by my heroes, as it were, in the time period that I wanted to write about in which they had a really good strychnine case. So I finally had to say to myself, okay, I'm just not going to do strychnine. I'm going to mention in the epilogue, and I think I whined about it a little bit, that I wasn't able to do it, but I'm going to tell the story of these poisons that these guys were kind of intimately involved with. And I'm going to tell the story of poisons, I think, that were really important at the time. So at the time, Prohibition is going on in the United States. It's almost the time period of my book. Prohibition, the constitutional amendment that sets off our prohibition of alcohol consumption and distribution, is passed in 1918 and overturned in 1934. And my book is really a story from 1918 to 1936. So, it just floats. Alcohol, poisonous alcohol, prohibition of alcohol floats through my entire story. And so I knew I was going to look at alcohol as a poison. And you'll see in 1918, the poison is wood alcohol. And then later on, there's a variation on that in which I look at it as methyl alcohol, which it's the same thing, but I was looking at it differently. And then there's actually a chapter on ethyl alcohol, which is the alcohol that we drink today in wine and beer and whiskey and everything else that we legally drink, but that is also in its own way quite an interesting poison. So it was that kind of, how am I going to make this story work? And that limited the poisons I looked at. I mean, I snuck some other ones in there. You know, I snuck in a little lead and leaded gasoline because I thought that was so important. So every once in a while, I'd kind of say, oh, I can't stand it. I have to get this poison into my book. But mostly, those were the big guys.
Wow, that makes sense. You mentioned that you focused on your two sort of central characters, or a bit of a partnership, a duo, the medical officer Charles Norris and chemist Alexander Gettler. Why did you find them to be particularly compelling to drive your story forward?
So I should back up and tell you that, you know, my agent said to me, write a book about poison. And I'm like, ooh, yeah. And she said, and you don't even have to write a long proposal, which is what you usually do as a nonfiction writer. You write, at least in my past, you know, 30 to 40 pages outlining the story, and you have a pretty good idea what you're doing. She said, you know, just write your option publisher, which is Penguin Press, you know, 2 or 3 page little letter saying that you love this idea. And I did that, and they bought it. And then I thought, help, right? I pitched a book that's basically said, poison's really cool, let me write about it. And then after I signed the contract and spent the advance, I thought, what is this book about? Right? Poison is everything. And I've always thought I wouldn't have found Gettler and Norris if I hadn't been so panicked. I did this 3-month hysterical tour through everything about Poison. What's a good story? What's the story that's going to carry my ideas about poison and chemistry and murder? And I realized after, you know, a little bit of digging that all the stories I was finding and all the books where I was seeing were not in the United States. They were all in Europe. And I thought, well, there must have been someone in the United States. And I literally found the first reference to Alexander Gettler in a newsletter, an internal newsletter of a forensic toxicology association. And there's this side reference to him as the father of forensic toxicology in the United States. And I thought, great, I'll just go read his biography, but there was none. And so, but I was so intrigued. Here was the guy who was the father of the field. Who was he? What did he do? And that really was where I started the story. And as I looked, I found he was an amazing, fascinating, absolutely, relentlessly determined chemist, and that his boss, Charles Norris, was one of the great crusaders, one of the great American public health crusaders of the early 20th century, absolutely fearless in taking on issues that he thought mattered. And I realized that the two of them were going to make an amazing story. And you know, I let myself feel really smug about that, but I've also felt really lucky that I found them.
They do make a really great story.
They're amazing people. They really were. I love that they were forgotten, and I love that they were civil servants, because they were revolutionaries and they were civil servants. And we tend to act as if scientists who work for the government, you know, are kind of monospeak drudges, and that's just not true. So I love that, too, this ability to take two forgotten civil servants and say, wow, look at what they did.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Deborah Blum, science writer and blogger for Public Library of Science, where she writes the often poison-related blog Speakeasy Science. We've just been talking about how you chose the characters and the stories to tell in the Poisoner's Handbook. Why do you think that historical stories about science are so important to tell?
I mean, for one thing, it's the fairly basic idea that you really can't understand where you are until you know how you got there. So you can't understand, you know, I'll talk about the CSIH. You can't really understand forensic science and how it works until you know how new it is. And understand how much we're still kind of figuring it out and have a sense of its roots. So that's part of it. I think for me, the other thing is when you go back in history in general, you understand science better if you know its story. You're able to put in context all the people who today say, well, I'm the first one ever had that brilliant idea, which isn't always true. And you can also understand how connected we are to our scientific paths. And one of the ways I've thought about this recently, really in the aftermath of Poisoner's Handbook, and as you mentioned, since I started doing my poison-obsessed blog, Speakeasy Science, is that a lot of the poisons that my guys looked at are still problems for us today. We still live in a chemical world that we struggle to navigate. We're still trying to figure out the, you know, chemicals, which chemicals are dangerous and which ones are not. And there's a lot of really important information about that in the past that we shouldn't throw away that can really illuminate sort of our steps as we work our way through this, you know, difficult map of the world today. And I think that's really important to remember.
Well, you just wrote recently about arsenic in rice, I believe. Is that an example where you think this historic understanding helps us understand those kind of issues today?
I do, because, you know, arsenic is a famous poison. It has a long history. It's probably the best studied lethal chemical element and its associated compounds in the history of the world, because it's poisoned so many people for so many hundreds of years. So I think some of it is that we can just understand what makes it dangerous and what makes it even homicidal by understanding its sort of historical past. But in the blog I wrote about arsenic and rice on Speakeasy Science, there's another really interesting historical point that I kind of just alluded to briefly, which is that in the early 20th century, a lot of the poisons I actually write about in Poisoner's Handbook, like arsenic and cyanide, were in fact popular pesticides. The sort of generation of insecticides and other pesticides that we use today really sprang out of work in World War II. So before that, compounds like hydrogen cyanide, was used as a pesticide in homes to kill rodents and things. And it killed a lot of people by mistake. I actually mentioned one of those cases in the book. But arsenic was one of the most popular agricultural pesticides of the early 20th century, laid on like a trowel, especially actually in the United States. I didn't mention this in the blog, but in the 1920s, they had some horrifying cases of people in England who were poisoned by arsenic when they ate apples from the United States. So much arsenic was troweled onto pesticides. So in the arsenic and rice piece, and this is a problem today, we're discovering that rice is one of the things that people eat that adds arsenic to the diet, and that the rice plant is sort of uniquely designed to bring us arsenic because the way it pulls different minerals out of the soil, it tends to really suck up arsenic. And so, people are saying, well, rice is one of the major contributors to arsenic in the human diet. If you look at a map of the United States, you'll find that we grow a lot of rice in our, sort of buggy Gulf states like Louisiana. And some of the arsenic that we're seeing in our food system now is from the use of arsenic to control the boll weevil in the cotton fields of the past. So, it really connects together. The way we used to use chemicals influences our chemical diet today, and we need to learn those lessons from the past on the way we use those chemicals, too. It would be a huge mistake to say, oh, arsenic is cheap, it kills a lot of things, let's start spraying fields with it again.
And we're left with it not just in stories, as you say. It's actually still having an impact in some ways.
That's exactly right. I mean, arsenic we're not like stuck with the residual traces of cyanide, because that's a pretty volatile compound, but arsenic's a metalloid element and it lasts for hundreds of years, so it makes a kind of fascinating example there.
In telling the stories in the book, I actually really enjoyed the really vivid descriptions that you gave. You really made the reader feel like they were really in the story and able to see and feel the story in the lab or the autopsy room. What kind of sources did you use to create those descriptions?
Well, I really appreciate that because I wanted people to feel like they were in the 20s, right? I wanted them to be there in the noise and the smoke and the colors of a laboratory of the time. And when you're putting together a narrative book in particular, in some ways I think of it as assembling a lot of pieces of the mosaic that makes the picture of your story. Obviously, there weren't a lot of people around for me to interview, but I did talk to the grandchildren of Alexander Gettler. That was one of the sources I used. I tracked them down. They had, some family journals and pictures and stories and documents that became part of the story. I used a lot of letters from Charles Norris and Alexander Gettler. I went to the New York City Municipal Archives, and they actually had, they must have had about 20-odd boxes of letters from the Norris administration archived by year. And I read every letter that they had in that archive. It was incredibly fun. I love doing archival research. And you have permission to read someone else's mail. What could be more fun, right? And so I read all of these letters, and I read them for the murder stories of the time, and I read them to get a sense of the personalities of the men, right? What did they do? How did they sound? What did they get angry about? Who did they argue with? All of that came from those letters. And then I read every single scientific paper that Alexander Gettler and Charles Norris ever wrote. I read through countless aging journals. I actually got a medical history librarian to help me with this so I could track down all their papers. And again, you know, sometimes the personality of the man comes through in the paper, or the obsessiveness of Gentler, and he was very obsessive. And then I read newspapers and magazines of the time, or some books. I mean, you know, there were occasional references in books. I read lots of magazines of the time. I used online archives of newspapers, and when those weren't good enough, I went to the New York Public Library and I got newspapers, New York area newspapers, on microfilm, which, as you know, is always a horrible challenge. And you know, papers like the Brooklyn Eagle that were never going to be in an online archive, but I wanted to know how those stories were covered. You know, I had to have a killing in Brooklyn. How was it covered? So, you know, I did that as well. And so, you know, you start as you're doing this, putting together a picture of the time. And I looked for sort of visual images of what New York was like at that time. I actually found, and it's just gorgeous, I wish I wrote as well as this, there's a WPA, a 1930s Work Project Administration Guide to New York City. This, of course, is during the Great Depression in America, and the government is putting, you know, everyone they can to work in these work project kind of jobs, and they put writers to work writing guides to cities. And I wish I knew who wrote this guide, because whoever wrote it, it was so much more talented than I am. I'd just be like fanning myself. Oh, I wish I wrote like that. But these beautiful images of New York and its streets and the way the city sounded in the morning and the way these neighborhoods worked. And so, you know, I'm putting all that together because I wanted people to be in the there. I wanted them to feel like they were right there in the 20s and 30s, kind of trying to figure it out, too.
We'll be right back to talk more about all things poison with science writer Deborah Blum right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Marie-Claire Shanahan, guest host this week for Desiree Schell. Today I'm talking to science writer Deborah Blum about her book, The Poisoner's Handbook. Deborah is a professor of science journalism at the University of Wisconsin and also a contributor to Women in Crime, Inc., a blog featuring analysts by female criminal justice professionals and authors. So we've just been talking about how you really used imagery to place the reader in the labs and in New York City at the time. There's also a lot of really vivid description of the chemistry, not just the surroundings, but of the tests themselves. We read about bubbling froth and Gentler grinding up tissue and how careful...
Slushy braids.
Yeah, there's a lot of really colorful descriptions. Why did you think that was really important to the story?
Well, I have to tell you, you're writing about the chemical laboratories of the early 20th century is so fun. I mean, today so much of it is automated. They've got these incredibly sensitive, wonderful machines like gas chromatographs. Yeah, you can pick up a flicker of a molecule and do all these amazing things. But the chemistry of the time, people call it wet chemistry. And by comparison, today's chemistry would be dry chemistry, right? But the chemistry of the 1920s was wet. People were messing around in laboratories. And it's so gorgeous to describe. I mean, occasionally really grisly, but just so fun to write about. And you could write about the fact that with the right test, you got this evening sky blue effect of cyanide, or this evil, glowing red in the dark kind of effect of carbon monoxide. I always tried to give my colors characters, and I wanted people to see it. And for one thing, it's beautiful. And as a writer, when you come to a sort of aspect of science, and you can say to yourself, wow, this is really gorgeous. It's such an opportunity to make people see, to enjoy the moment, I think, because we enjoy beautiful things, but I think also as science writers, to make people see how beautiful some of these things are. And I've thought about this recently. I heard Theo Green, who did the iPad app, The Elements, talked about the fact that people are afraid of chemistry, and one of the ways we can kind of seduce them back into it is to show them how beautiful chemical elements are. And if you look at his app, which is about the chemical elements, it's, mm-hmm. Stunningly beautiful. I heard that after I wrote my book, but I have to say that as a science writer, those times when you can just say to your reader, wow, isn't this gorgeous, are such a kick. It's so fun to put those together. And so I really tried to do that when I thought it worked.
The colors really came through in the chemical tests. I've never felt like I could see flame tests so vividly. I've never read about them like that. Thinking about the chemistry, there's also a lot of points where you stopped and explained chemical processes. Like you talked mm-hmm. about the processes involved in distillation, for example, as you said, talking about wood alcohol. How did you decide how much to explain?
Yeah, that's always a really tricky one when you're both writing about science and also writing a narrative, because my book's basically a narrative, and you want your narrative to keep moving forward, right?
Yeah.
It's like got to have a forward momentum, and even we hope it, a feel of accelerating towards something good. And when you say, well, okay, now I'm going to explain this, you're always aware that you're running the chance that you're slowing down the story too much. And so I really tried carefully to pick those moments. I wanted people to know how it worked. How did they figure this out? They're just figuring out how to detect these toxic elements in a corpse. And they don't have the fancy machines. How do they know? And, I think, just to use an example, talked about the fact that mercury, if you do it just right, creates this kind of beautiful silvery mirror on glass. But so I want to talk about that. How did they figure this out? How did it work? How did the test work? And to do that, what I had to do is figure out where in my story of a mercury murder mystery, and I had one, do I stop and say, whoa, we have this woman, she died of what may be mercury poisoning, but how are we going to figure that out? Well, let's take a moment and try to see what a scientist might do at this moment where they're trying to sort out the weirdness of mercury. And so I would do some of that at this moment where we've hit a puzzling point in the investigation. Let me tell you a little bit about this. But I would also break it up. So then I'd say, and now we'll do this. But later we'll come back and we'll realize that wasn't good enough, right? We know it's mercury, but it's not a good enough test to really tell us what kind of mercury it is. And so then what would we do now? And so what I really tried to do was weave those moments through the story until you actually find out in the case that I'm thinking of that the husband did not kill his wife. But you have to first work through it with the scientist. In a sense, you have to be the detective, too. And I wanted that to be in it, too, to channel a little bit of Agatha Christie and say, oh, I wonder if you can figure this out.
I found myself doing that as I read it, actually. I was thinking about, is this going to turn out to be the husband, or is this going to turn out to be...
Yeah,
it read like a bit like a mystery novel that way. When you're thinking about those points and deciding maybe not so much where, but how much to actually say or what terms to introduce, perhaps, do you sort of imagine an audience and what you might need to explain to them?
Yeah, I always imagine an audience because I think that makes us better writers, right? You're writing to a person or a group of people. When I started out as a newspaper science writer at the Sacramento Bee, I always imagined actually a person from my childhood in the American Deep South, which was a kind of elderly woman going down the driveway to get the newspaper. Don't tell me why I saw this so vividly, but she had those pink foam curlers in her hair, right? She's like half asleep. She's got pink foam curlers. She doesn't care about science. How am I going to make her interested in the story? And so when I was a newspaper science writer, she was my audience, you know, the person who never thought she would be interested in science, and I wanted to suck her in to the best of my ability. And I've always liked that better than, you know, I did a piece in the fall for Scientific American, which was really fun and was about semiochemistry, the chemistry of chemical communication. But I know in that case I'm writing for a very science literate audience, no pink curlers, right? So I'm going to describe it differently. It's going to have a lot more scientific detail, and I'm going to be more comfortable with some of the sort of terminology of science. When I wrote Poisoner's Handbook, I think I was probably aiming for somewhere in between there, someone beyond the, you know, the pink curler reader. But I wanted people to read this book who would say, oh, chemistry, I would never read a book about chemistry. So in that sense, the whole thing about the subtitle was probably right in the end. You know, the murder mystery reading audience, the kind of people, yeah, I mean, you mentioned that I blog for women in crime, the kind of people who love true crime stories, the kind of people who would not normally say, well, I'd like to read a book that's going to explain very carefully to me, you know, the chemistry of a toxic metal like mercury and in detail describe the laboratory experiments that tease it out. So I'm really thinking of that audience, right? The non-inner circle audience, I'm already in the circle and I already love science audience. And to me, always, that's the audience I love the best. I love that audience that is not inner circle. I love trying to seduce those guys into thinking about science and to realize that it's important to them and it's part of their daily lives and that it's not that hard to get what is really interesting about it. You don't have to run the experiments to get that they're fascinating and how they work. But you can enjoy the kind of idea anyway. So I, you know, that's my favorite audience. I love it. I actually did a piece, it comes out sometimes this spring, for a English department literary journal called Tin House. And I wrote it about the weird chemistry and history of food coloring. Why do we color food? Aren't we weird? Why can't we just eat what nature gives us, right? I love that idea. But I love the fact that that is not a science audience, right? And every time I get that opportunity, I go for it. So, you know, I mean, I think my way through it. But that's my favorite audience, the ones that don't want to read about science. I love them.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. My guest is science writer Deborah Blum. Deborah White writes the often poison-related blog Speakeasy Science. You're talking about reaching an audience that doesn't necessarily decide to go and pick up a book about chemistry and sort of finding a way to bring them in. And I think that actually kind of brings me to what I saw as one of the other themes of the book, which was this unwitting exposure to poisons. There are a lot of stories of accidental ingestions and fumigation deaths, and they're kind of unsettling in the way that people just didn't know what was going on. How important do you think those kinds of stories are for us now?
I think they're hugely important. You know, we still have all of those issues in different ways. We're smarter. And we have scientists that can tease out this information a lot better than they could in the 20s. And it's made a huge difference to us in terms of public health. And it's made a huge difference to us in terms of homicidal investigation, right? We don't see the serial poisoners and the frequency of homicidal poisoning of the past. But we still have accidental poisonings. It makes me crazy to some extent. My example would be carbon monoxide. And I have a couple of chapters about carbon monoxide in my book, and the incredible rate of accidental carbon monoxide poisonings in the 1920s. And we still have, not to that degree, but if I pick United States statistics, about 500 people a year die from accidental carbon monoxide exposure, and about 15 to 20,000 go to the hospital. And on Speakeasy Science, I do a once a year kind of, you know, poison roundup called the Poisoner's Calendar. I've only had that blog for 2 years, so there's two of them. And it's basically a calendar of carbon monoxide deaths. And at the end of them, every time I say, can we quit doing this? Could we just be a little more aware? How dumb can we be? This is an old poison. We've known it's dangerous for 100 years. Put the dumb carbon monoxide detector in your house. Check your generator before you fire the silly thing up. Just every time I read of one of those deaths, I think, what a waste when we already know this, and how do I make this better? And I do think that. Can I change this? Can I make it better? If I say this another time, is someone else going to get it? And some of that, you know, probably very naive, quite crusading spirit inspires some of the posts I do on speakeasy science. But yes, you had that kind of accidental poisoning. You had back then accidental cyanide poisoning. You had this phenomenal occupational health exposure when they started making leaded gasoline. Just unbelievable. And workers died and went insane from the, you know, literally insane amount of lead exposure in those early factories. I mean, we're a lot smarter than that. And then I think it's different, but one of my favorite stories about occupational exposure has to do with radium. It's the one radioactive element / poison that I use, and I tell the story of young women who were hired to paint luminous watch faces in the 1920s, and actually in the 30s and 40s, but they were called the Radium Girls, and the paint that they used glowed due to the inclusion of the element radium in it. And this is a great example of what makes poisons interesting. Good poisons take advantage of the way the body works naturally. Right?
Yeah.
It's like we're exposed to a lot of dangerous things. I've thought about this. I worry that I think about poisons too much, and I worry that I know too much about them, actually. And many of my friends think the same thing. But this I've thought about. I mean, we live in a chemical world. We're a walking collection of chemicals ourselves. We're exposed to different chemical compounds every day. We breathe them, we swallow them, we eat them. Most of them don't hurt us. So the ones that we do are really uniquely designed to do harm, and they often take advantage of the way our own metabolic processes work, the way our body works. Certainly carbon monoxide does that. It uses the very proteins in our blood that normally carry oxygen to kill us. Right. And radium looks like calcium structurally. Mm-hmm. And so these poor watch girls who were, you know, painting numbers and lip pointing their brushes were swallowing radium, and their bones broke inside them. I mean, it was a horrible story. And so I used that to kind of talk about the way we think about radioactive materials. You know, how excited people were when they first found them and how amazing they thought they were. And how our idea of what's safe and what's not also changes. And I think we're still doing that, too. You know, we're still saying, wow, this is a cool chemical. Oops, no, that one's kind of dangerous. So you still see us, you know, kind of feeling our way through those same thought processes. Yeah, at a greater level of sophistication, we hope, but in a similar way on occasion as we did in the 1920s.
I noticed in the book, actually, sort of throughout, but in a couple of particular spots, you listed kind of a shocking number of everyday household products with really toxic ingredients. You talked about arsenic-based dyes and thallium hair removers.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, really crazy. I would be surprised to walk into a store and expect something like that to have thallium in it right now. But am I kind of being naive about that, though?
That's a really good question. No, you're not naive, because about in the late 1930s, the United States and many other countries started saying, wait a minute, we've got a lot of poisonous things in food and cosmetics and medicines, and we have actually got to pay attention to these. And in the United States, there was a case in which cough syrup for children was sweetened with a compound called ethylene glycol, which is actually known today as antifreeze. And more than 100 children died within a week. And there was no law requiring the manufacturer to put the ingredients on the label or to safety test any of those ingredients. Yeah. No,
no safety testing requirements and no law requiring any information given to the consumers. And in 1938, the United States said, okay, we're done with that, and passed the law that gave us in our country the modern Food and Drug Administration. Mm-hmm. But before that, you'd go out and buy cosmetics, and you're absolutely right. There'd be thallium in the face creams. There was lead in hair dyes. There was some really corrosive materials, believe it or not, mascara. And the no information, no safety testing, and no information. We're, you know, so much better off than that. Are we perfect, though? No. And a good example of that, there were a lot of stories about this recently, was the RFDA, just under great consumer pressure, released an analysis of lead, which is a known neurotoxin, in lipsticks. And they looked at 400 lipstick brands in the made by a wide range of manufacturers, some very high-end and some very low-end. And, you know, some of these lipstick brands had, I'm thinking more than 7 parts per million. That was the highest, about 7 parts per million lead contamination, and that's not an ingredient. It's actually a contaminant that tends to occur in some of the dyes, especially in red lipsticks. There's actually a particular compound called red lead that, you know, causes a lot of problems. Now, you say to yourself, just to put that in perspective for a minute, it's not an ingredient. It's a known contaminant. It's at an extremely low level of 7 parts per million. It's way higher than, say, the EPA level for lead in drinking water, which is in the parts per billion. But we don't eat lipstick, we hope. And so the question then becomes, and this is where I think we're still fumbling through it, does this scare me, right? Lead bioaccumulates. I know that every lead exposure adds up. If I'm one of those people who reapplies her lipstick, you know, I wish that there are times that I wish that I was a complete glamour girl, but I, you know, I'm not one of those people who reapplies her lipstick. So I think you put a kind of personal common sense to this, right? It's at a fairly low level. If you're not using one of the high-end brands, if you don't eat your lipstick, if you're not reapplying your lipstick about 40 times a day, then there's probably not an issue. Do we know that for sure? No. So, you know, that's where we have the problem. Do we need to keep looking at this stuff, trying to figure it out, get the information out there? We absolutely do. Do I wish that our consumer protection agencies like the FDA were more aggressive about this? I absolutely do. I wish they were out there. And just to quickly give you another example, you know, I blogged about the problem of rice and arsenic. And one of the things I noted in that blog is neither the U.S. nor Canada has a food safety, food consumption level of arsenic. Really? Neither. Because they don't know how to figure that out, right? And, you know, how much rice does a single person eat? Do we do a standard for rice? What if it's rice grown in Louisiana that has a lot? What if it's rice grown in Thailand that hardly has any? I'm using the rice example. So, you know, one of the things that I think then that's really important for people like me and you and other people who care about science communication to do is to keep getting this information out there so that we start, you know, so that, one, consumers can make some common sense decisions. Do I need a carbon monoxide detector? Absolutely, yes. Do I panic about my lipstick? Probably not, right? And keep trying to get that out there. And also, I hope, get enough information out there that sometimes it adds up to putting pressure on government agencies and they say, you know, we really have to do this. We really have to take a careful look at this. We really do have to set limits. And I actually would like to see more of that and more funding for them to do that, obviously, which would be the other issue.
Well, I think we're actually just about out of time. Thanks so much for joining me today to chat about all things poison. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you for letting me wax about my favorite subject in the world.
Thanks. We've included links to Deborah's book and blog on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And since you're there, maybe click the links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to Google+ to get program updates, and to iTunes where you can subscribe to the show, listen to past episodes, and leave a review.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're diving into the fascinating math that describes the world around us. Guest host Rochelle Saunders speaks to Malcolm Roberts, PhD applied mathematician at the University of Alberta, about fluid dynamics, the math that models motion in fluids, gases, and plasmas, and reveals the secret to pouring the perfect beer. And Desiree Schell talks to theoretical astrophysicist Ethan Siegel about building a reliable science and health news aggregator. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
I'm here with Bora Zivkovic, blog editor at scientificamerican.com, and one of the founders of the absolutely brilliant annual Science Communication Unconference, Science Online, in Raleigh, North Carolina. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Great to be back.
So you'll be coming to see us in Edmonton soon to present a talk about the use of storytelling in science communication. Now, is telling stories a better way to communicate science than more traditional methods?
I would say so, because human beings are natural storytellers and story listeners. So presenting data as a table requires some preparation, some training. While we are all naturally attuned to stories, so telling a science story as a story, as a narrative, is a wonderful way to hook in people who are, you know, lay audience, or, you know, scientists in other fields who are lay audience for your field. So I think it's a natural way of talking and explaining things. And storytelling has different forms, of course. When I say narrative, there's a very particular meaning to that. It has characters and dialogue. when we talk about storytelling in a broader sense, even scientific paper is storytelling. It tells a story where the ideas come from, then how it was done, what results came out, what it all means, and where do we go next. Even the kind of very formalized shape of a scientific paper that gets published in a journal tells a story in some way. When we go away from the scientific paper and try to explain the science to lay audiences, it becomes even more important, because the formalized scientific paper often doesn't go in, let's say, chronological order. The characters are hidden. Very, very few scientific papers start with "I did something." It's more written in passive voice, kind of experiments did themselves without anybody watching.
Right.
So you know, there are these formalisms of the genre. Although it's a story, one has to be trained listener for those kinds of stories. For the untrained listeners, for the lay audience, one has to adjust that style to something that people are more used to. One of the things that people are used to, which is not really storytelling, is your typical journalistic inverted pyramid,
right?
Kind of writing, which is something that was devised because of the demands of publishing on paper, where there is very expensive real estate property on the paper, and, you know, editor is going to decide how much space is going for each story, and that can change from minute to minute until the thing actually goes to print. So a writer might, you know, be told to, you know, use 4 inches and ends up being 3 inches, so the editor is just going to cut the last inch, so that that forced writers to write within an inverted pyramid, where the punchline is first. That's probably the title, and then the most important piece of information is first, and then less and less important information, because if that gets cut, it's okay. Which means that the most important context usually gets lost, because it's either at the end or gets cut off. So most of the stories provide the context first, what kind of world you're inhabiting in this story, who are the characters, kind of sets the stage for the story to unravel itself. In a typical kind of news piece, you don't have that. You get a punchline first. And that's not the kind of a natural storytelling arc. And but people are used to that. And now today, in the age of the web, when it's not really sure if you're, you know, coming to an article from a link on Twitter or from a search engine, you have to kind of orient yourself. Okay, what kind of site is this? Am I going to read now a traditional news story or a blog post or a feature? Or, you know, is this going to be short or long? Is it going to be inverted pyramid or not? Is it going to be a narrative or not? So people are having to learn new skills of figuring out quickly at first glance what kind of article they're going to be engaging in the next, you know, few minutes. Which is, you know, different people are at different stages of learning how to do that. And sometimes they are, you know, disappointed because they expected one and got another.
Are there particular science themes that work better as those narrative kind of stories?
I think everything can be written as a narrative. Some stories are much harder. I would say animal behavior, discovery of a new fossil, those are kinds of things that are probably the easiest to turn into narratives and into exciting narratives that people are going to just, you know, lap up and love it. There are other things that are harder. For instance, you know, it's hard writing about the, you know, solution of the, you know, mathematical problem that's been bothering mathematicians for a century, and suddenly, you know, finally somebody managed to figure it out and solve it, and the solution takes, you know, 350 pages of equations. How do you explain that in an exciting way? And very few people are capable of doing that. Actually, we at Scientific American are incredibly lucky that we have probably the best math writer in the world in Davide Castelvecchi, who is now back in Italy, who can turn the most obscure and difficult mathematics into a story that is just riveting. That is hard to do. That takes a lot of knowledge and a lot of talent and practice over time to pull off. So, and everything else is somewhere in between. You know, things when somebody discovers a new detail in some complicated intercellular pathway are probably harder to tell. You have to go broader into what does it mean for, let's say, a disease or understanding evolution or something like that. It's harder to tell the story straight. Okay, this is the discovery and this is the context for it because we know all these other players inside of the cell. So different fields present different levels of difficulty on turning them into stories, but I think everything can be.
Can you give me an example of a story that you would tell?
The story I would tell. I love stories about scientists and how they got to discoveries, which are often serendipitous discoveries, something that, you know, who was it? Asimov said, you know, the most important word in science is not eureka, it's this is funny. So, you know, you can have a $5 million grant and an enormous lab and you're working on some humongous project and then you see something that's funny. Something's weird with the data and you start exploring that and that's where your big discovery comes from. One type of narrative which people really like is actually following the scientist on the field, line to this discovery, which is often very curvy, circuitous line. It's not straightforward. Okay, I had an idea, I got a grant proposal, and, you know, I spent $1 million, and here it is. It's often how people got into science and how they got to the particular problem. And how they got to solve it is often the most fascinating story, especially if it turned out that, you know, the big discovery actually did not require $1 million. It was, you know, done with duct tape and, you know, some wire and some string. I love those kinds of discoveries. It's like, oops, you know, observe something and, you know, do a back of the envelope of the calculation, a simple experiment that, you know, costs, you know, 50 cents and bam. People love those kinds of stories.
I love those kinds of stories.
And it's very interesting. I mean, I don't know, maybe it has to do with me coming from Eastern Europe where there's really no money for research, where you kind of have to do these things with, you know, sticks and ropes, that kind of mindset that you have to think deeply and thoroughly through a problem and come up with a creative way of solving it, which, you know, in rich countries you may be trained to, you know, just, you know, turn on your PCR machine and go, without necessarily stopping and thinking and of maybe cheaper, quicker, more creative ways of answering the same question. And so that's kind of seeped into my own research when I was in grad school, and I spent a decade in grad school and a decade out of it since then, where kind of the coolest things that I discovered were those kind of, this is funny, followed by, let me try this, not needing any new grant proposals or any new, let's say, IACUC, that's the, you know, animal care things. You know, I could piggyback on the existing experiments or just, you know, measure, watch, or count something. So probably the most interesting thing is what I did is I just collected my, I was working with quail, you know, a Japanese quail, a bird. All I did was count the eggs my birds laid every day for about 3 years. That's all I did, and write it down. Of course, sometimes I had to go to the lab to count the eggs in the middle of, you know, ice storm, snowstorm, hurricane, whatever. Things happen in North Carolina with weather. But, you know, I did it and discovered interesting things which, you know, other laboratories using modern molecular techniques could not get to. So I love those kinds of stories.
So where do you want to take the science storytelling genre? Where do you want this to go in the future?
You know those books that have multiple endings that you can, you know, okay.
Ooh, choose your own adventure books. I love those.
Exactly. Web is perfect for that because you can follow links and you can have layers. So web allows one to get out of linearity in much better way than anything on paper can do. So you can follow your own story the way you want by following a bunch of links or following, you know, images in a slideshow. Also, web allows one to insert, you know, videos, animations. One way that you can make your own story is sliders. And I don't mean pork sliders in a bun. What I'm talking about is having, for instance, a website, which is, you know, carefully designed and beautiful, where users or readers can move the sliders left and right, thus changing the inputs, while, you know, there's an algorithm behind it that changes the outputs. And I've seen a couple of those before. There was a couple of years ago, or was it a year ago, when there was a big budget fight in the United States Congress, where people could try to balance their own budgets. I mean, trying to balance the federal budget by using essentially sliders, giving more or less money for different programs and trying to add up to whatever budget was the total. And then through that, discovered how difficult it is that, you know, you can't have everything you want because there's not enough money for it. So there are all sorts of ways that one can do that with science. You know, if you change inputs, how the outputs change. If you change, let's say, use of energy, how does it change global warming? So those are kinds of things that are very intuitive, that get people to work and do get them on the passage of exploration and discovery themselves, which is probably the best way to tell a story, by involving people and letting them become characters in the story themselves. That they have some input and they can follow various paths over and over and over again if they have patience and excitement about it, and see how different, you know, turns in the story can lead to different endings.
Just like real scientists, really.
Just like real scientists, and that turns everybody into a scientist. So the scientists are not just, you know, there's, you know, weird looking people in white coats that are looking at strange questions that, you know, mere mortals cannot, you know, become a scientist by going on a tour of the universe with the scientist and become one yourself.
And if you're in the Edmonton area, you can catch Bora Zivkovich at The Artery, 9535 Jasper Ave, on Friday, March 9th, for Beyond 42, How Science Can Use Stories to Explain Life, the Universe, and Everything. It's a night of storytelling and music, finding the people, places, and things that make science what it is. For more information, check our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.